Welcome to this week's episode of Off the Assembly Line. I'm your host, Rebecca Reed, and every week I sit down for possibility-sparking conversation with innovative educators and entrepreneurs who are bringing the future to education, one beautiful disruption at a time. So good to be back with you guys. This is Rebecca, and I cannot wait to share this week's episode with you. I've got some exciting news to share with you first. Learn Kind, the kindness curriculum that I've been building with the team at kindness.org, was released yesterday and will be used in pilot classrooms across the country through the spring. If you want to know more about it, go to kindness.org or send me a message. I would love to tell you more. I also wanted to let you know that the Education Innovation Virtual Town Hall is going to be next Tuesday, 1 week from today, February 25th, at 6 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We've still got a few spots left, so if you want to be a part of the conversation, go ahead and register as soon as you can. Registration will be open until Monday or until all the seats are filled. If you've got questions, send me an email at rebecca@teachermastermind.com and we will go from there. Okay, on to the episode. This week's conversation is such a treat as I'm speaking with education journalist and author Natalie Wexler, whose work is regularly featured in outlets like the New York Times, The Atlantic, The Washington Post. She's also a senior contributor to the Education Channel at Forbes. Last year, Natalie released a book called The Knowledge Gap: The Hidden Cause of America's Broken Education System and How to Fix It. The book dives deeply into the most common approach to reading comprehension and the reasons why it misses the mark. It goes on to share the foundational shift that changes everything when it comes to reading comprehension. I don't know if you guys have ever come across a paper or a method or a tool or even an idea and thought, if we get this one piece, it could truly have an outsized impact. That's how I felt after this conversation. Natalie shares the key insights from her research and what happens when this knowledge gap gets closed. Here we go. Natalie, welcome to the show. I'm so looking forward to talking with you today.
Well, thanks, Rebecca. I'm delighted to be here.
Absolutely. So I've been on this journey recently exploring innovation in education, and one of the things I've been so grateful for are the researchers and journalists like yourself who are shining more and more of a light on the so-called achievement gap and tying that gap really to the true underlying causes. And it's the stuff that, like, if we can grab a hold of it, it can really affect change. So you recently released a book called The Knowledge Gap: The Hidden Cause of America's Broken Education System and How to Fix It. And whew, that is a book title and a half.
Yeah, I know. Not too ambitious there.
No, not at all. But I love it so much. And, you know, we're going to get into the nuts and bolts of the book, but I'd love to start with the why behind the book. Why did you write this one?
Well, you know, it wasn't like I have nothing against this, but some journalists think, well, it's time for me to write a book, look around for a book topic. And that really wasn't how this book came about. This was a topic that just kind of came up and begged to be written about. I just really stumbled across it. I mean, I had been writing about education really mostly on the local level here in DC, and with a particular focus on what's called the achievement gap, or, you know, it was really the gap in test scores between essentially the, you know, students at the top and bottom of the socioeconomic scale. And I had also been involved in the education reform movement to some extent in DC. I was on the board of a charter school, and I actually thought I knew a lot about education. I thought I understood it, but, you know, I had been involved in the reform movement and writing about education for years, and I just kind of accidentally stumbled upon this huge, pervasive, fundamental issue that nobody seemed to be talking about, at least not, you know, the people I'd been listening to. And I'd been going to expert panel discussions and reading everything I could get my hands on, and I just couldn't believe, you know, there had been, to be clear, people had written about the issue that's at the heart of the knowledge gap before, but I would say not in a way that really captured public attention. It was, you know, there were people who were talking about this issue, but when I stumbled across them, I realized they were basically talking to each other, and it hadn't entered the public conversation. And it seemed like what was needed was a journalistic narrative treatment of the issue that would appeal to a general reader.
Mm-hmm. Someone to really take and synthesize all of these different conversations and all these different pieces and pull them together.
Yes, and take the reader into classrooms and introduce, you know, sort of characters and just make it more, I mean, it's a pretty abstract, complex subject, which mm-hmm. I'm sure we're going to get into more. Mm-hmm. And I was trying to make it as engaging and concrete as possible.
Mm, love that. So I don't mean to bury the lead, but I am going to just a little bit. And before we get into what you call that problem that's hiding in plain sight, I want to start with the symptoms. And so you touched on it a minute ago in talking about the so-called achievement gap, the gap in test scores. From a symptomatic standpoint, how has this problem, this gap, been presenting?
Well, I mean, it's clear. So No Child Left Behind ushered in this era of high stakes tests. And I'd say the real advantage of that was it uncovered a lot of largely hidden inequities in our education system. I mean, an A at one high school is not going to necessarily be equivalent mm-hmm. to an A at another high school. And what testing did was to provide this sort of one standard basis of comparison that really shined a light on the fact that there were people, demographic groups in our society who were clearly not doing as well as measured by these standardized tests as others. And then there are other indicators like, you know, college going and college completion and even high school graduation. It's going up, but, you know, there are still students of color and low-income students are generally not doing nearly as well as higher-income students. And, you know, in our society, white people tend to be higher income. So there's also more white students doing well and more Asian students. So that's really the gap.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Yeah, so then let's dive into it. What is at the root of this problem? Your book talks about the problem that's hiding in plain sight.
Well, so what I had assumed the problem was, what I had been told the problem was, what a lot of education reformers have assumed the problem really is the high school, that things fall apart in high school. Mm. And so there's been a lot of effort to like reform high school. And that is really where I started thinking. I volunteered in a high poverty high school so I could get a better sense of why high school was such a problem. What I stumbled across really by accident was that the problems that become so apparent in high school do not start in high school.
Right.
And a lot of them really have their roots in the way we teach elementary school, and specifically the way we teach reading. And what I'm focusing on is reading comprehension. Mm-hmm. There are two basic components of reading. You know, there's decoding, which is figuring out how to read words. And then there's how to understand, you know, a paragraph, an article, whatever. That's comprehension. And we have problems with both of those components. Mm. There's been a lot of attention lately on the problems with the decoding side, the word reading side of reading, which really that should be taught as a set of skills, like, you know, basically under the umbrella term phonics. And it's quite apparent that even though teachers may think they're teaching systematic phonics, they're often not doing that. But what I discovered was, an even more pervasive and better hidden problem, even though, as I say, it's hiding in plain sight, which is the approach to comprehension. And the assumption there is that reading comprehension can be taught as a set of discrete skills, like finding the main idea or making inferences. And there are a whole bunch of them. And the standard approach is that there'll be like a skill of the week that the teacher will focus on. Maybe it's determining the author's purpose. So the teacher will choose a book to read not for its content, but for how well it seems to lend itself to demonstrating whatever the skill of the week is. And then students will go off and practice that skill on books that have been determined to be at their individual reading levels. And that could be years below their grade level. And basically the theory is that if you, you, first of all, that you can teach these skills directly, and secondly, that if students practice these skills diligently, it doesn't really matter what their content is that they're reading, as long as they're practicing the skills, that they will be able to apply those skills generally to, you know, a reading passage on a standardized test at the end of the year, or, you know, later on to a high school textbook. And what I discovered was, I mean, I hadn't realized that this was the approach, even though I had seen it in action, but that approach really does just conflicts with what cognitive scientists have found about how reading comprehension actually works, which is that it's really not a question of skill, that the most important factor in reading comprehension is how much background knowledge and vocabulary the reader has relating to the topic they're trying to read about. And so if you want to boost reading comprehension, if you want kids to become good general readers, then rather than spending all this time on these largely illusory skills, what schools should be doing is building their knowledge as much as possible and the vocabulary that goes with it. And that means teaching them about history, about science, about the arts in a systematic way with a coherent curriculum. And that's happening in very few elementary schools. And in fact, especially in schools where test scores are low, we've been eliminating or marginalizing things like social studies and science in order to spend more time on these reading comprehension skills, when in fact we should be doing the opposite.
Right. I mean, that you're describing my experience as an elementary school teacher. That's sort of the path that's laid out for teachers to walk. And I think, you know, where it is happening that content rich sources are being brought in, I think very rarely it's happening systematically and in a very intentionally structured way. I'm curious if you can take us into the cognitive science just a little bit, if we could maybe just dip our toe in a little bit and speak a little bit to what knowledge is actually providing for students developmentally. What's going on in the brain at that stage?
Well, I mean, the way cognitive psychologists sometimes define knowledge is that it's a change in long-term memory. I mean, to define knowledge is a complicated thing to do, mm-hmm. because it could be knowing about a principle, or it could mean being able to explain that principle, or it could be being able to apply that principle. But when it comes to reading comprehension, the key thing to realize is that authors inevitably leave information out, and they expect the reader to be able to supply that information, because it would be very tedious to explain every reference that you are making in a book or a text. And so if you don't have the information that has been assumed, you're going to have a hard time making sense of that article or that text. And one example that I often use is what's known as the baseball study. Have you heard about that?
I'm not sure.
Well, this is a study that was really a groundbreaking study, but it was done a long time ago in the late 1980s by a couple of cognitive psychologist researchers. And they wanted to test out what is more important to reading comprehension. Is it general reading comprehension ability, skill, or is it knowledge of the topic? And they took a group of 7th and 8th graders and divided them up into four groups, depending on how much they knew about baseball and how much they had scored, how well they had scored on a standardized reading test. And then they showed them a passage to read describing a baseball game and tested their comprehension. And they chose the topic of baseball because they figured there are a lot of kids out there who are not generally good readers, but they might know a lot about baseball. And what they found when they did this study was that the kids who knew a lot about baseball all did very well when their comprehension was tested on the passage about the baseball game. Mm-hmm. It didn't matter how well they'd scored on that standardized reading test. Mm-hmm. And similarly, all of the kids who didn't know much about baseball scored very low. Again, regardless of how well they had scored on a standardized reading test. In fact, the supposedly poor readers who knew a lot about baseball did significantly better than the supposedly good readers who didn't know a lot about baseball. That and that study is, you know, pretty convincing evidence that knowledge of the topic is more important than some kind of general reading comprehension skill. And since that study was done, it's been replicated in a number of other contexts. And it may be, you know, a matter of common sense to some extent. Yeah, sure. If you don't know about baseball, you're going to have a hard time reading a newspaper story about baseball. Or if you don't know much about microbiology, you're going to have a hard time reading a scholarly article about that topic. I think what is less obvious, two things are less obvious. One is how much background knowledge we, all of us as educated adults, bring to pretty much any newspaper article or whatever that we're reading. And second, the second thing that's not so obvious is how much some kids don't know about the wider world,
right,
how much vocabulary they are unfamiliar with. And that was something I encountered again and again when I was researching the book. So, I mean, some kids do pick up the kind of knowledge and vocabulary that is tested on standardized reading tests and also helps you in school. Those kids tend to come from more highly educated families, which in our society, of course, is largely correlated with income. And so it's the kids who are not picking up that kind of knowledge at home. They're not picking that up outside of school. They're the ones who rely on school the most for that kind of knowledge. And ironically, they're the ones in our current system who are least likely to get it there.
Right. Well, you know, it's so interesting because, I mean, you mentioned that in a way this, it's like common sense. And I was just thinking of my first few years in the classroom, our third grade students was speaking with their teacher after our state standardized tests, which in Florida are very high stakes. And we were talking about some of the topics that had been coming up in the practice tests leading up to the state testing. And in one of the reading comprehension practice texts, the topic had to do with Antarctica and icebergs mm-hmm. and polar bears.
Mm-hmm.
And the students in that classroom struggled so mightily with comprehension of that text. Why? Because they struggled so much with comprehension in general? No, it's because they lived in the state of Florida. Almost none of them had even seen or touched snow before. So the ability mm-hmm. to just apply reading comprehension skills to a very abstract concept, it just didn't translate.
Right. And it's funny you should mention that because one of the things I have in the book is a sample question from a Common Core Align third grade reading test all about the life of the Inuit in the Arctic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, uh-huh. I show that also with the words blacked out that a lot of kids, mm-hmm. even kids who live in places where there is snow, they may not understand, you know, the Arctic and caribou and, you know, and if there are too many of those words that you don't understand, some studies have said even if it's only 2% of the words in a passage are unfamiliar, you're going to have a harder time understanding it. And if it's like 50%, you know, it's pretty incomprehensible. Mm-hmm. And of course, we should add for anybody out there, I'm sure you realize this, but there may be listeners who don't realize that the passages on reading comprehension tests have nothing to do with what kids may have learned in school.
That's right.
You know, mm-hmm. they're designed to be random and not to align with what might be part of the curriculum because they don't want to give some kids an unfair advantage. So they try to base this on things that kids, you know, sort of general knowledge. But if, you know, if you have less general knowledge and vocabulary, you are always going to be at a disadvantage.
Mm-hmm. So what are the first steps that educators need to take to begin to tackle this gap and start to do things differently? I mean, do we just start with awareness? I'm thinking of the assumptions that we all bring to the table, these unintentional biases that come to the surface. Do we start with that, or is there somewhere else?
Well, I wouldn't necessarily phrase it in terms of biases. I mean, there are certainly assumptions about what kids know that may be incorrect, but I would say, I mean, for individual teachers, it's going to be hard to really tackle this problem. Because knowledge building is a gradual cumulative process that extends over a period of years. So ideally, what you have is you're working within a school or a system that has adopted a coherent content-focused curriculum so that it focuses on topics, not on these reading comprehension skills. And, you know, I mean, I think if you are a teacher who, for example, is in a school where they're using a Basel reader or something like that, that focuses on a skill of the week and the passages the kids are reading or you're reading aloud even are pretty superficial in terms of content, you can supplement that Basel reader with resources. You know, I mean, this puts a lot of the burden on the teacher, but, you know, find more things that you can, especially read aloud to kids that will build their knowledge, because reading aloud is crucial. Kids can take in more sophisticated knowledge, more sophisticated vocabulary and concepts through listening than through their own reading. Not just, you know, even after they've learned to decode, this is on average through middle school. So by reading aloud, you're going to be able to build knowledge much more efficiently for kids. They can follow along, but it's going to be much more efficient for an expert reader to build that knowledge through reading aloud than for kids to try to do it on their own. The other thing is that kids need to written language is always more complex than spoken language, and kids need to get used to those conventions, that syntax, and reading aloud to them from written texts that they themselves can't access is a great way to build that familiarity. But ideally, as I said, to really build kids' knowledge, you'll be in a system that has adopted one of these fairly new content-focused elementary literacy curricula. There are half a dozen of them out there now.
Yeah, let's talk about the schools that are doing things differently. First of all, what does it look like in the classroom? And then if you want to unpack maybe one or two of these curricula, what they look like and what they're bringing to classrooms, that I'd love to give our listeners a picture of what's going on.
Sure. I did, as part of my research for the book, follow two, turned out actually ultimately to be three classrooms, but the idea was that I would follow two early elementary classrooms, one using this standard comprehension skills focused tech approach, and the other using one of these newer content focused curricula. And that curriculum happened to be called, it was one called Core Knowledge Language Arts, which is the oldest of these content focused elementary literacy curricula. And you know, the classrooms were not identical. No two classrooms are. One was a first grade classroom. One was a second grade classroom. But they were all of the children came from low income families. They were all children of color. And the teachers in both these classrooms were hardworking, dedicated, smart teachers. But the classrooms were like night and day. And it was largely because of the curriculum. So in the skills focused, and when I say skills, I mean comprehension skills, in that skills focused classroom, it was very hard to get a discussion going. There really weren't any classroom discussions because the kids were not interested in talking about main idea or, you know, how does a caption differ from a subtitle? They were first graders and they just weren't interested in that. Whereas in the other classroom, the second grade classroom, where those kids in the second grade classroom had been using this curriculum since kindergarten. So, you know, they already had quite a bit of knowledge under their belt, but they were having these rich discussions about ancient Mesopotamia and Greece and the War of 1812 and all sorts of, you know, that they got up through the Civil War, but they had already learned about the colonial period. They had learned about the American Revolution. So, you know, when they got to the War of 1812, which I have to say, you know, the average American would be hard pressed to tell you what that was all about. Right. These kids could discuss that war intelligently and its causes and, you know, and they were, and I should add, they were totally engaged in it. They were on the edge of their seats waiting to find out who was going to win, the Americans or the British, you know. So it was both a more engaging experience for the kids, and it was also good for them. I mean, not only were they acquiring knowledge that would stand them in good stead, but they were actually learning and using very sophisticated vocabulary. You know, when I had lunch with a group of them in March, they were using words they had picked up like revenge, opponent, labyrinth. And most of the kids in this class were from non-English speaking families, and some of them were still learning English themselves. But, you know, these are words that will stand them in very good stead when they get to high school and beyond. So I would say, you know, I think teachers may fear, and I certainly heard this from teachers and coaches, that this kind of content-focused curriculum, which includes topics in history and, you know, some fairly sophisticated things, is going to be not appropriate, you know, developmentally inappropriate, or that the kids won't be interested. And I would say the opposite was true. The kids were fascinated, especially by the historical topics, but also some of the science topics. And they were just eating it up. You know, kids, they love, when they're in kindergarten, first, second, third grade, they love to feel like they're becoming experts about things. And you tell them mm-hmm. an engaging story, even if it's, you know, it may be conveying a lot of information, but they just like a good story. And history, especially, can be told as a series of pretty good stories.
Right. So here's a question that I have, just kind of thinking about some of the fears or hesitancies that might pop up for educators. There is endless knowledge to explore, endless topics. In the context of reading comprehension, can you choose the wrong topic? Is there knowledge that is going to be very problematic if it's skipped over? How do educators start to sort of curate the content that they'll bring into reading comprehension?
Well, I would say, first of all, that educators themselves, individual teachers, shouldn't be trying to do that. Mm. I mean, it's there are these curricula out there that have already sifted through the many possibilities. Mm. And each of these curricula focus on a somewhat different body of knowledge and present it in a different way. And, you know, so not, you know, one may be right for one district or school and another for a different one. You know, not everybody has to have the same exact body of knowledge. There's no list out there. But I think I would say that anybody who designs a curriculum, I mean, first of all, it's very helpful if there's at least some logic to mm-hmm. the sequence, especially if it's something, well, not especially, but I think it's true with science as well. But think about, you know, it's going to be easier to understand the War of 1812 if you know about the Revolution. It's going to be also easier to understand the Civil War if you know about what came before it. So you can introduce topics in a logical sequence that will help kids understand, absorb, and retain information. But I also think, you know, we need to think about what do we want kids ultimately to know so that they'll be able to, for example, understand a newspaper, that they'll be able to understand the issues in an election and exercise their responsibilities as citizens in a way that makes sense. So I think there are, as I said, I mean, there's no like list, mm-hmm. but I do think there are certain fundamental things that, you know, frankly, a lot of high school students these days have not yet been taught in a way that sticks with them. For example, I've talked to, and I've seen, I've been in high poverty high schools, and I've talked to teachers in high poverty high schools, and it's really not uncommon for kids to not understand the difference between a city and a state, or a city and a country, or a country and a continent, or not to be able to find the United States on a map of the world, or their city on a map of the United States. These are very basic things about, you know, the world that, it's very hard to make sense of the world if you don't know these things. So at the very least, you know, I think we can all agree that we need to be teaching kids those things. And waiting until high school is going to make it much more difficult to teach those things in a way that kids really can understand and absorb and retain. If you don't have a framework to fit those things into, and you're expected to be learning those things, you know, at a high school level, it's difficult both for teachers and students.
Absolutely. I think that's, a wonderful way to frame it. For the classrooms that are bringing knowledge-based curricula in, what are the conditions that have to be right for these kinds of changes to happen. In other words, you mentioned, you know, a few times that really the burden cannot be on the shoulders of the teacher to make these kinds of big time shifts in their instruction. Who is making the decision to shift, and what other conditions need to be in place for schools to really start moving in this direction?
Yeah, I mean, those are all good questions. And, you know, I think it really has to be a multi-pronged effort. I think it has to start with the adoption of a content-focused curriculum. And that's obviously going to have to be at least at the building level, if not the district level. But, you know, it's not going to work if it's just top down either, because teachers, you know, historically, if a new initiative doesn't make sense to them, and they're often being bombarded with new initiatives, they will just close the door and teach in a way that makes sense to them. So the leadership, whether it's at the building level or the district level or the state level, or what, they need to understand why this change is necessary. But they also need to bring teachers along and explain to teachers, not just tell teachers, okay, now we're doing this new thing, which I think is often the way it happens, but also explain why it's important to do this new thing, and why actually it could make your job a lot easier, you know, and be better for your students. I think one difficulty in our current system is all of the pressure from testing. And the tests, as we mentioned, are not aligned to any particular body of knowledge. So it, you know, teachers could do a lot of knowledge building. Their kids could know all about Greek myths and the human digestive system, but then the reading passages at the end of the year are about, you know, the Inuit or whatever, and the kids will not be able to demonstrate their skills because they won't have yet accumulated enough knowledge, general knowledge, to enable them to understand pretty much anything that's thrown at them, as long as it's not too technical or abstruse. So that can be very discouraging and distracting. And I do think one promising development is what's happening in Louisiana, where they're experimenting with a reading test that is tied to topics covered in both their ELA and social studies curricula that the state has developed. So not every state's going to be able to do that, but, you know, it would make this change somewhat easier if, you know, test designers said in advance, for example, okay, the fourth grade reading test, we're going to cover the following three of the following six topics or something, you know, westward expansion, the human digestive system, whatever. And then teachers would have an incentive to focus on content. They'd have some idea what content to focus on, and their students would have a fighting chance of doing well on the tests.
Right, absolutely. So from a systemic standpoint, you know, we're talking about changes at the building level, maybe at the district level, maybe at the state level. But when we look out across the entire landscape, if we have the opportunity to play this out and the majority of classrooms begin to approach reading instruction in this way, what does the systemic impact look like at that point? And then what is the actual potential to get there?
Well, I mean, you know, I don't know that we're ever going to be able to level the playing field completely between haves and have-nots. That's, you know, there are wealthier kids in this society are always going to have advantages. But I do think that, you know, if enough schools shift to this approach, which I think is not, you know, certainly not going to happen overnight, but eventually I think you will see less of a gap in test scores. You will see kids, even kids from less educated families, arriving at high school with a base of knowledge that will equip them to do high school level work, and then moving on to college with a base of knowledge that will equip them to do college level work instead of being stuck in remedial classes that, you know, cost them money but don't earn them any credit, which is often what happens now. And you know, I don't think that I think I would like to see a society where it was not necessarily the expectation that everybody has to go to college, because I
Right.
think we're asking college to do a lot of the work that K through 12 education should be doing and isn't. But I would like a world in which whether or not you end up going to college is not, as we've said for a long time now, determined by your zip code. You know. So I do think, you know, I have seen I went to London as part of my research for the book and visited a school there. I mean, L England has a somewhat different system. This is, I'm not saying this could be replicated here, but it was a school in a low-income area that took kids in at age 11. And some of those kids, I was told, came in reading at the level of a 5 or a 6-year-old. But with a really intensive approach to building knowledge, they had caught virtually all of those kids up to where they should be within 2 years. And the head of that school told me, you know, they won't all in the English system, there are these tests, GCSEs and A levels, they won't all go on to college, was her expectation. But even if they don't, even if they then go and learn, you know, how to be barbers or whatever, carpenters, you know, they go on for some kind of training, they will have had, you know, effectively a pretty good liberal arts education. I mean, these kids were writing about, you know, tragic flaws in Macbeth and whatnot, and they were, you know, like 13, 14 years old. So I would love to see a society where, you know, even if you don't go to college, you've got a pretty good education under your belt that enables you to do all the things that we hope education will do, to be, you know, to have a richer life, to take an active part in society, and, you know, to have a decent job.
Absolutely. And it's so interesting that you brought up how they were approaching the remediation portion of students' reading instruction, because I was wondering what might it look like for middle schools and high schools to take a similar approach?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is. It's not impossible at middle school and high school. It is definitely more difficult. And you know, the approach that Michaela takes is going to be hard to replicate because it is so different from what most American teachers and most English teachers, for that matter, British teachers, are used to what their expectations are. So, but I would say that one thing that can work at any grade level, including high school, to help fill in gaps in knowledge and also to build knowledge and analytical abilities, is a certain kind of writing instruction, and not generally the kind. I mean, we don't pay much attention these to in our education system to teaching kids to write. We kind of expect them to pick it up, but to the extent that we do focus on writing, it's often not grounded in the content of the curriculum. It's like personal essay, or it's a separate writing curriculum about whether we should have chocolate milk in the school cafeteria. And it's also, we also have this assumption that kids should just write at length and develop their voice and their fluency. And the problem is that writing is a very difficult thing to do. Well, it has great potential for building knowledge if you have kids write about what they're actually learning. But if you ask them to write at length and they're inexperienced writers, it was such an overwhelming task that they will neither learn to write well, nor will they really be able to reap these knowledge building benefits from writing. But so I co-authored another book a few years ago called The Writing Revolution, which sets out a method of writing instruction that does the things that I'm talked about. It's grounded in the whatever content you're teaching, whatever grade level, whatever subject, but it also doesn't ask kids to write at length if they don't yet know how to construct a good sentence. And it that the advantage of starting at the sentence level is that it teaches kids to write sentences, which is really important because if you can't write a good sentence, you're never going to write a good essay. But it also modulates the cognitive load so that kids can reap those knowledge building benefits. And where do those benefits come from? Two things that cognitive psychologists have studied in other contexts. One One is that you are retrieving information when you write that you've slightly forgotten. That's something called retrieval practice. Mm-hmm. And that really helps to cement information in your long-term memory. And secondly, you're putting it in your own words. Again, very powerful. That's been studied. It's called the protege effect. It's been studied mostly when you have one student explain something to another student, but that helps with comprehension, retention, analytical abilities, you know, all sorts of things. So that's why writing can build knowledge in such a powerful way that it really can compensate for a lot of those gaps. It can fill them in pretty quickly.
Mm-hmm. And really what I'm hearing through all of this is the importance of bringing in a very focused, a systematic approach.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, this, you know, I think teachers in this country are used to having a fair amount of autonomy. And it may be hard for some teachers to give that up, but it is really important for students to get this, to have this coherent experience. That, you know, one downside of having teachers decide what they want to teach is that you could read Charlotte's Web three times, you know, in three different grade levels. But also, if, you know, all of this, the knowledge, the writing ability, it takes time. It develops really not over months, but years. So, you know, you need that consistency across grade levels.
Mm-hmm. Let me take a little bit of a turn here, Natalie, and ask you about the role of parents in all of this. For any of our parents listening who are undoubtedly extremely interested in this topic, what would you tell them?
Well, you know, what I've heard from schools that have adopted this approach of building kids' knowledge beginning, you know, as early as possible, is that parents are thrilled because suddenly their kids are coming home eager to tell them about what they learned in school that day, which is often pretty impressive stuff. And they don't generally come home eager to tell you all about how we learned how to, you know, compare and contrast or find the main idea. So I think, you know, I think parents have, and this is certainly, my kids are grown now, but when they were kids and when they were in school, I just sort of trusted the school and the teachers to know what they were doing. And I didn't really look into what the curriculum was that much, or, you know, and I totally understand that. But I think that if parents really understood what was going on in almost all of our elementary school classrooms and how it conflicts with what scientists have found about how children learn, that they would be up in arms. Mm. And I think, you know, that whether or not they know about that science, they can tell when their kids are excited about learning. And that's what happens. You know, you can implement any curriculum badly, but when one of these curricula, you know, these content-rich curricula, when it's implemented well, the parents are thrilled.
Absolutely. Before we start to close out here, Natalie, I'd love to know if you were to give one first next step to educators and school leaders who are looking to make a shift in their approach to reading instruction, what would that first step be?
I think it would be, and this I think is happening in some places, find people teachers, principals who really are interested in trying this new thing, rather than saying, okay, the entire district, you know, or what is going to just do this. I think what's going to be most convincing and powerful is if you do it, begin with people who are really engaged in trying this and give them some time to figure it out. And then when they seem to have a good handle on it and it seems to be working, bring in others to see it. And they will see that. I was at a school in Delaware where this had happened. They visited a neighboring district that had adopted one of these new curricula, and they saw that the kids were loving it and the teachers were loving it, and they wanted to do it too. They were only in their first year, but they seemed to be doing a great job with it. And everybody was really loving it. So I think for many not just teachers, many people, showing is going to be more powerful than telling. Absolutely. So to the extent you can show them that this really can work, that's what I think we need to do.
I absolutely agree. Yeah, find the early adopters. Mm-hmm. So I always love to close each episode out by asking my guest, who are you giving an A to? And that can be anybody you're involved, who's involved in your work, in your life, in the landscape of education or beyond. Who are you giving an A to these days?
Well, there are some real bright spots that I've heard about out there. I since I wrote the book, I really haven't been in that many classrooms, so I can't really say this is from my firsthand experience. I mean, I certainly thought that the second grade classroom I followed, I would definitely give an A to, but that teacher has moved elsewhere, and that was years ago. From what I've heard, I would say on the state level, Louisiana has been doing some really smart, interesting things, including piloting that new kind of reading test I mentioned, which instead of just testing kids on what they may have happened to pick up in terms of knowledge, actually tests them on what they've been taught. And they've done a number of other things, rating curricula for, among other things, how well they build knowledge, creating their own content-focused curriculum, not requiring districts to adopt it, but making it easier for them to adopt it, and really building a network of teachers throughout the state who they have, the state has educated about all of the stuff that we've been talking about. And I think, you know, that there's still a long way to go, but RAND has been studying, among other places, has been studying Louisiana, has found a very high level of, relatively speaking, of teacher understanding of all of these issues. And then at the district level, I know Baltimore and Detroit have also adopted content-focused curricula. I know a little bit more about Baltimore, and they seem to be doing a good job. Again, I haven't been in classrooms there. And then there's smaller, you know, non-urban districts around the country. There's some in Tennessee that have been experimenting with this, and the reports are really promising from those places.
That's wonderful. It's wonderful to hear. I normally would go from this question to asking how people can connect with you, but I do have another question that I'd just love to get your insight on. Knowing that most teachers don't have access to very easily digested and applied reading instructional research, is there a body of research or even a journal article or something even more accessible than that that you would point every teacher to?
Well, there's a lot of stuff going on Twitter lately, and there are definitely some resources out there. If you could use the hashtag ELA chat or curriculum matters or knowledge matters, you'll find a lot of stuff. I would also refer people who are interested in going deeper into the cognitive science around reading comprehension to read the work of Daniel Willingham, who is a cognitive psychologist at the University of Virginia, who writes in a very accessible style. He's written several books. The Reading Mind, I think, is maybe the most recent one, that really sort of lays out in more detail some of the things we've touched on.
Wonderful. Thank you so much.
Sure.
And then just to close out, Natalie, how can people get connected with you and your work?
I'm on Twitter at Nat Wexler. I also have a website, nataliewexler.com, which has a bunch of information about both the writing revolution and the knowledge gap, and links to articles I've written, and a way to contact me if you are interested in doing that.
Wonderful. Thank you so much. It's been such an honor just such an enjoyable conversation. I feel like I have learned a lot in the process. Thank you so much for being on.
Well, thank you. This was a real pleasure. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Off the Assembly Line. You can find episode details in the show notes and additional resources at offtheassemblyline.co. Go to RebeccaAreed.com to register for the Education Innovation Town Hall, or shoot me an email for more info. Off the Assembly Line is produced by me, Rebecca Reed, with many thanks to our incredible guests. If you like what you heard, be sure to rate and review the podcast on Apple Podcasts or whichever platform you're listening on. Until next week, Be kind to yourself, be kind to others, and as always, lean into possibility.